Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess and a special advisor at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it or put it on iPad, iPod, or any device and hit play. Today, we have a real interesting show, which I'm thrilled to be doing. You know, there are moments when you feel a little bit older, and one of them is when you look back on a show you did in the past and then offer an update. So I guess ESI Bytes now has some real track record, and I'm thrilled that about 2 years ago, we did a show on e-mediation when it was just an article and a concept that an attorney in Texas, Peter Vogel and Allison Skinner, pitched to me that we should cover on ESI Bytes. And I'm glad that we did this, as that idea has turned into an organization called the American College of E-Neutrals, with a number of e-discovery pioneers on their board, including Tim Opsitnik, who's also joining us today on the show, along with Allison Skinner, who's the co-founder of this group. As we thought about revisiting the topic, I thought the concepts presented in this organization are very similar to the thought process behind the e-discovery special master program, which is occurring here in the Western District of Pennsylvania. In fact, the two guests and myself are all approved special masters in that innovative program. So I figured if we could combine the ingredients here, we might have a great show. So I invited several of the judges who I know were instrumental in forming that program to join us, and I'm pleased that Judge Schwab from the Western District of Pennsylvania has joined us today to talk about how e-mediation fits into the Western District, the PA Special Master Program. So in terms of formal introductions, the Honorable Arthur Schwab was nominated by President George Bush on January 24, 2002, and confirmed by the U.S. Senate on September 13, 2002, and sworn into office on January 1, 2003 for the Federal District Court in the Western District of Pennsylvania. Prior to joining the Federal District Court, he's clerk for the Honorable Colin J. Seitz, then chief of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He worked at Reed Smith, LLP, from 1973 to 1990, where he served as deputy head of the litigation group and founding chair of its TechLex technology group, law group. He worked at Buchanan Ingersoll Professional Corporation as their chair of litigation, and then as chief counsel for complex litigation. He's past chair of the civil litigation section of the Pennsylvania Bar Association, past president of the American Inns of Court Pittsburgh chapter, past member of the Board of Governors of the Academy of Trial Lawyers of Allegheny County, and past chair of the Council of Civil Litigation section of the Allegheny County Bar Association. He's the chair of the Joint Information Technology Committee and past chair of the Court's Case Management Electronic Case Files Committee and Alternative Dispute Resolution Committee, which is very relevant to today's podcast, and the special e-discovery master program established in the Western District of Pennsylvania. Allison Skinner, our second guest, is a full-time neutral with Surratt and Permut Mediation Center, a mediation facility in the southeast. She's the co-founder and charter member of the American College of E-Neutrals Advisory Board. Allison serves as an adjunct professor for e-discovery at the University of Alabama School of Law, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and the Thomas Good Jones School of Law in Montgomery, Alabama. She authored the Teacher's Manual for Shinlin Capra and the Sedona Conference Electronic Discovery and Digital Evidence Cases and Materials, published by West in 2008. She's nationally recognized for her work in the area of e-mediations and serves as a special master for e-discovery matters. She sits on the inaugural e-discovery special master panel for the United States District Court for Western District, Pennsylvania. She regularly lectures on e-discovery and alternative dispute resolution at national and state levels. And prior to becoming a full-time neutral, she litigated complex cases in civil court. I also should mention she helped me with my lawblogreview.org initiative to help e-discovery law students. The last guest, Tim Opsitnik, is the senior partner and general counsel of Jurnov, which he founded in 2000. Tim is at the forefront of practitioners addressing issues involving the discovery of electronically stored information and development of case management and document management systems. His consulting practice focuses on the development of litigation and document management systems, document and electronic data warehousing, electronic discovery, electronic risk management, and computer forensics. His clients include U.S. and international law firms and companies. He has also conducted numerous continuous legal education seminars regarding e-discovery and other technology issues. Not many people know that. He was one of the original founding members of the Sedona Conference and helped to raise its initial funding, and he's always been a substantial supporter of ESI Bytes. In addition, Tim has served as a special master and an expert witness in cases as substantial as the World Trade Center litigation, and he's on the initial advisory board of the American College of Eden Neutrals. Prior to starting Jurnov, Tim was with the law firm of Jones Day from 1986 to 2000. Glad to have all of you on the show, and I always like to start my programs by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. And Judge Schwab, why don't we start with you and then Allison and Tim?
Well, I got interested in e-discovery as when I was practicing, having gone back to the early 70s and being involved in technology coming through and founding the TechLex group at Reed Smith, which was basically a technology law group. We started that process of learning about technology at that point, and then I followed through on e-discovery since. As we moved increasingly from paper to electronic transmission. I actually remember the day of sitting in a warehouse in Elwood City, Pennsylvania, that was unheated, that had about 2,000 boxes of documents. So I can remember that day, but also I'm pleased to be in the time period in which we now can look at things electronically. So that's sort of my history, and because of my technology interest and background, I was chosen by the Board of Judges to head up the IT committee at the United States District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania, and then chaired the case management and e-discovery and, committee. The particular program we have now for special masters for e-discovery was really founded and brought to bear and fruition through the efforts of Joy Flowers Conti and Nora Berry Fisher, both of which are likewise district court judges with me on the Western District. So I want to give them credit for what we're going to talk about today.
Great, thank you. I remember herniating my disc before we had e-discovery lifting boxes, so I remember those days well. Allison, how about yourself?
Well, I have a similar story. Carl, thanks for having me today. I recall being in a warehouse with 17,000 banker boxes of documents, but I really can't recall not being involved in e-discovery in cases, because I represented national clients and a lot of them in the automotive industry. So we were searching databases, for example, and doing quite e-discovery before it was cool, if you will. And then I left my litigation practice to become a full-time neutral. And I just wanted to continue that training and experience that I received representing these great clients. In electronic discovery, I even headed up the technology committee of my firm. At the time, we didn't have what you would call an e-discovery committee. But in doing that, I decided that, you know, hey, I want to bring electronic discovery to the ADR field. And I had actually mediated discovery as a litigant and one time for a full week. So I knew that there was a need to apply ADR to e-discovery, and that led me to writing the papers and starting the college and talking here today with you. So it's been a long journey, but one I certainly have enjoyed, and I've enjoyed teaching e-discovery because it's such a hot topic, and it's a great opportunity for students to learn an area where they actually have a lot to add when they join their law firm.
Okay, and Tim, how about yourself?
Carl, thanks for having me. And my path was similar to the others. But interested in e-discovery or drafted in e-discovery? Drafted is probably a better explanation. I was a young lawyer working at a large law firm, and much as the others have described, reviewing large sets of documents and boxes and figuring out how to put them into databases and things like that. And we had discovery requests for databases. It was the late 1980s, and somebody said, hey, if you can figure out the technology associated with how to put these litigation support databases together, then, you know, we're drafting you to work on e-discovery matters as well. So, and the rest is history.
Yeah, you know, lots of people get sucked into the field by being the first volunteer. So great. Well, let's jump into the topic. Judge Schwab, why do you think mediation can be an effective tool in electronic discovery disputes? I mean, we always hear about in complex commercial disputes or divorces or things like that. You know, why e-discovery?
Well, I have three points that I wanted to mention. The first one, it brings a knowledgeable person into the discussion. You could have situations where neither lawyers or only one side counsel really understands electronic discovery. And so by bringing this mediator, that mediator can also be educating the lawyers and helping the lawyers work through the issue. So bringing a knowledgeable person that's neutral is certainly one of the advantages. The second one is that the mediation process provides a forum to work through the many detailed issues relating to e-discovery disputes. Otherwise, one would be filing motions to compel, maybe having a judge that understands or doesn't understand these issues, and it's a the litigation form through the court takes time. You may not get a knowledgeable person, and you may not get decisions in a timely way, where the mediation process can be a one-time event and reach an agreement, or it can be an ongoing process, but it provides a forum in which people can work through these issues. And lastly, thirdly, I believe that the mediation can be very cost-effective. Obviously, in large cases, there's the resources on both sides to hire specialists and to litigate these discovery disputes. But even in the smallest case, where there's limited resources, a mediator can cut through the discussion and bring the parties together in hopefully a short meeting. So I believe it's cost-effective. So I think it brings, one, a knowledgeable person, provides the forum, and can be very cost-effective.
Great. Allison, let's talk a little bit about the American College of E-Neutrals. What is it?
Okay, well, what it is, it's a member organization, and it provides a free directory to the court and to the parties to identify a qualified e-neutral to help them navigate and resolve e-discovery disputes, whether that's at the outset of a case when the parties are developing their discovery plan, or, you know, if they get on down the road and a certain issue comes up, so, you know, issue-by-issue basis. I'm often asked, what is an e-neutral? And I kind of describe it as an umbrella term, because an e-neutral is a referee who's trained in ADR and e-discovery. It's the umbrella term for an e-mediator or special master, discovery referee or magistrate, liaison or an arbitrator. I mean, we hear all these different terms of how we use our third-party referees, but it just depends on what part of the country you're in and what ADR mechanism you're using. So the idea of having this one term to cover all those different roles that a referee might be playing seem to make sense. So we use the term e-neutral. The more I have spoken about conflict resolution and e-discovery and on e-mediation, including on your show, Carl, and that was a lot of fun doing with Peter, the more people responded, hey, this is a great idea, but where do I find a qualified e-mediator? And the same thing was happening to Peter. And so Peter and I decided, let's create an organization that helps the courts, helps the parties find someone and just be the go-to organization for that. And so the directory is designed to locate a e-neutral by name or geography or even your practice area. For example, I have experience in aviation, and I was asked to serve as a special master on e-discovery in an aviation case in Texas. And you have to, you know, recognize that depending on the different industries and practice areas, you need that level of specialty. So we think that is helpful. You can find the American College online at www.acesin. That really stands for American College of ESI Neutrals, and I hope that the listeners today will check it out.
Great. You know, it's funny, the seventh podcast I did was with Jonathan Redgrave before I did the show with you, and he'd written a law review article with Judge Shinlin on the special master program. And I jokingly said, so where do you find a special master? Do you go to the yellow pages? And I guess we're now addressing that problem.
Exactly.
So,
and I know for me, when I was the first one in Alabama to be appointed as a special master for e-discovery. And so the first thing I did was, you know, Google trying to find someone similarly situated. And I actually had a hard time. Tim's name came up, Peter's name, Craig Ball's name, Ron Hedges' name, but what, that's like four in the country?
They've all done shows on ESI Byte, so I guess you just look at past participants here.
Right, right.
Well, Tim, what convinced you to evolve from a traditional e-discovery expert role, which is, honestly, it's a rather exclusive group of tech-savvy people who've been solving complicated problems, to embrace e-mediation as a discipline, which my sense is going to grow a little bit quicker than the more exclusive tech groups? Or do you have thoughts on that?
Well, my motivation for getting involved in this role is much the same as my motivation way back when we started the Sedona Working Group 1 to focus on these issues. I felt that we in litigation had lost touch with the substantive issues in the cases. Too much time was being spent on matters that really didn't have a whole lot to do with the substantive issues of the case. And I might add, not only time, but money. There was a disproportionate amount of dollars being spent on electronic discovery matters and have been spent on electronic discovery matters when, in my, you know, from my standpoint, I thought there were common sense solutions to a lot of the problems that litigants faced. And it was very frustrating to watch from afar people struggle with where I thought was an easy middle ground and place that each of the parties could get to that would provide them with just what they needed to try the case and move forward in their representation of their respective parties.
So, Judge Schwab, when do you think e-mediation is an appropriate strategy to embrace? Is it when you run into a problem, or is it at the beginning, or do you have a sense?
Well, let me put you in context. In the Western District of Pennsylvania, we initiated several years ago a mandatory ADR process, and every case except a few categories are required to go through an ADR process of either mediation, early neutral evaluation, or non-binding arbitration. And that's been a very successful program, and we've cut the number of cases we had over 3 years, something about 80%, and we cut the number of motions 6 months or older also under 70 by 70 or 5 or 80%. So it's a well-accepted program. It's been successful, and it occurs in the context of the filing a stipulation for ADR and is part of the Rule 26F report that's filed with the court. And it this occurs, and the selection occurs prior to the initial case management conference. At the initial case management conference, there is discussion about various matters, including e-discovery. The form that we have that's online in the Western District of Pennsylvania for the 26F report actually has a series of questions relating to e-discovery or electronic stored information and discovery thereof, and walks through, is someone seeking this kind of discovery? Is there, will metadata be relevant? Have the parties agreed on a format? What do we do? Is there some agreement on inadvertent production? What about search terms? Is there agreement? What about accessibility, preservation? So these questions are all in the 26F report that are reviewed by the judge prior to the initial case management conference. And at that conference, then, under our program that we have in place for e-mediation, relating to e-discovery, we had that discussion at that conference, and the judge has the information from the 26F report in order to have a meaningful discussion. And so if there is a need for mediation, that decision generally is made at the initial case management conference, which is generally within 60 days of the filing of the case. Regular mediation must occur within 60 days thereafter, absent an order of court. And we have prepared not only an order as to which ADR process will be followed and the timetable for that, we also have online, which we'll talk about later in the program, a form that we use for the appointment of a e-neutral to work any work through any ESI dispute issues. So that's a long answer. The short answer to the question is that we do it early in the case, and I would think that it's certainly available later in the case if there's a problem. But if competent lawyers answer the 26F questions and work through these matters ahead of time, then I would say in 90% or more of the cases, if there's going to be a need for mediation relating to e-discovery, that decision will be made and implemented at the initial case management conference.
Great. Allison, can you, I know the field's sort of early on, but at this point, can you point to any successes in the e-mediation field?
Oh, absolutely, I can, Carl. I was thinking about e-mediation that I conducted, and I had plaintiff's counsel on one side and defense counsel on the other side of the table, and we had just resolved a huge issue for them in the e-discovery. It had been a major hurdle that had really held up the case for several months. And about the same time, they both looked at me and said, all right, now when we meet this deadline and do these things we've just agreed to do, if we run into any problems, can we come back and see you? Well, as a mediator, that's something you never hear, the parties saying, hey, can we come back and see you again? And I think that shows that they saw how the process was working, and they knew that it had real value in their case. And another e-mediation, the plaintiff's counsel, was a little skeptical, and I think he saw attending the e-mediation as maybe just another additional expense in the case. And so he was a little reluctant, but then after we worked through everything and he stopped me and he said, you know, this was worth it because the process had saved time, money, and a relationship with a client who was really frustrated that things had gotten stalled because of the discovery battle. So I think that the more the lawyers engage this tool, they see the benefits from it and realize, you know, this is a process that we know how to utilize, we know how to work through. And wow, we look good to our clients that we are moving our case along. So I definitely have been able to witness those successes.
Okay, great. You know, although to sort of do it both ways, like any process is not a guarantee, right? I mean, there's certainly you can get intractable parties that can't mediate, can't you know, it's going to take the litigation process. Is that true too?
But let me make sure. You mean what is the other side? Have I seen people?
This works real well a lot of the times, but there's also sometimes it's not going to work like anything.
Oh, well, and that's what I try to share with people. I mean, if you have litigants that cannot agree the sky's blue, then probably using a facilitator like an e-mediator is not the right choice. And that's when probably utilizing a special master is more appropriate because they have the appointment and the authority from the court instead of the parties mutually coming together for the mediation. You'd have the special master who has that authority and can help make decisions and move the parties forward. So definitely.
Okay. Tim, we hear a lot about the Sedona Conference's cooperation proclamation. And I'll add that Judge Fisher from the Western District was the 100th judge to sign this. Since you are the only original member of the Sedona Conference on the podcast, would you care to summarize the Cooperation Proclamation and how it ties into e-mediation? I mean, only original member. Sorry about that, Allison.
Well, let me say, I certainly don't speak for everyone in the Sedona Working Group 1. I mean, that's the nature of Sedona, but I certainly do have my opinions on this. And, you know, the way it ties into mediation is that it frankly has the same rationale or foundation. And, you know, let me explain further that, you know, the cooperation proclamation, when we started this process in 2008, was modeled after Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It was intended to provide a coordinated effort to promote cooperation by all the parties to the discovery process and to achieve the goal of just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. The proclamation was intended to refocus litigation towards the substantive issues of legal disputes, much as, you know, I've already mentioned. And, you know, it was a three-part effort. You know, the first part was to bring awareness by mentioning the proclamation and discussing it. And the second part was to draft a Brandeis brief-type document, which, you know, provide all the basis for the arguments for why it was an appropriate way to proceed. And the third, which just came out in March of this year, was really to provide a toolkit for litigants in ways in which they can approach this. You know, by way of example, you know, it's intended. Well, an example would be that to get the parties to agree on the data sources for preservation. Sounds pretty common sense, but, you know, litigants can save a whole lot of time, effort, and money if they can just agree up front that these are the data sources and these are the places in which we're going to preserve data, and we don't have to worry about these other things.
Right. Hey, Allison, in your article, Promoting Cooperation with E-Neutrals, you talk about the three goals of using E-Neutrals. What are they, and how do E-Neutrals help where lawyers might have problems? Also, if you want to mention where you can find the article.
Oh, sure. Okay. The article was published by DRIs for the Defense in May of this year, so you can find it there. But in that article, what I was really trying to express is that cooperation is not a dirty word. Cooperation is something we as litigants know how to do. We just need to, you know, stop and think about it. So I don't want to be too long-winded here, but what I tried to do is explain, you know, what is cooperation? How does cooperation serve the client's best interest? And then how do you effectuate cooperation? So on the first point, you know, what is cooperation? Well, you know, I don't believe cooperation is turning the keys over or agreeing to do everything opposing counsel has asked. And I think that's why cooperation, as we talk about it in the context of e-discovery, has gotten a bad rap, because that is just not natural for litigators. But I don't think that's what cooperation is about. I think our rules of professional conduct guide us on how we litigate cooperatively. And so I call it the four C's of cooperation found in the rules. And that's to be competent, rule 1.1. If you're competent in what you're doing, then you have the confidence to be able to make the agreements that you need to make. The second one is communication. Like, look at rule 1.6. The third C is candor. You know, be candid about your forms of production, your data sources, your preservation issues. You have that responsibility. And then the fourth C is compromise. Look at rule 3.4. You have that duty of fairness. You can't obstruct the opposing party's access to evidence. So, and part of that compromise piece is, if you cannot do that informally or through formal pleadings and you need assistance, that's where your E-Neutral can come in and give the parties assistance. And that second piece, like, how does cooperation serve the client's best interest, which I think is very important for litigators to recognize that cooperation is in the client's best interest. I kind of boil that down to three points. You have mutuality of interest. I mean, let's face it, if you can't get through discovery, you can't get to trial. Our discovery process is meant for us to be able to evaluate strengths and weaknesses of our case so we can reach resolution. The second point would be economic efficiencies, which the judge was talking about cost savings. When we cooperate, we are saving our clients financial resources, even human resources, and that's always in the client's best interest. A third point I made in the article was just preserving your credibility is in your client's best interest. You know, if you get in a huge discovery battle and you're always before the court and the court believes you're acting like children, or I cite a case in the paper where the judge called it the equivalent to the cafeteria fight in Animal House. I mean, if you're at that point, you as a lawyer are losing credibility, and you're losing the credibility for your client's position, and that's detrimental to your client's best interest. I'll leave that more for the judge to talk about, but it is one of those concerns and factors you need to think about as you are looking at cooperation. And then the last piece is really, if you need help, we have tools to do that in our process, whether it's mediation or special master, and that helps the client's interest.
Okay,
so that's probably the article in a nutshell.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a limited license to the phrase 4C, okay, because the 4C discovery wine, just don't brand wine, I think we'll be fine, but that's great.
Okay.
Judge Schwab, that was actually a really good lead-in for a question I wanted to ask you, the sort of Animal House scenario. I wanted to ask you to distinguish the special master, which is an officer of the court, whereas the e-neutral is employed by the parties. So do you have any sense of when it makes sense to have a special master used versus an e-neutral, the mediator? And what do you think about the Animal House scenario? Do you like having these tools at your disposal?
The process that we have in the Western District of Pennsylvania really blends the two, so as the judge and the parties learn more about the case, they can go from e-neutral to special master. So I think it's very difficult for a judge early on in a case to know which is necessary, and that's why, as I mentioned before, we have in our Rule 26F report, we ask detailed questions about the ESI issues. We also ask in question 14 of whether there's a need for a special master. So at the initial case management conference, which, as I said before, generally occurs within 60 days of filing, we can have a meaningful discussion. And then our form for appointing a special master permits the special master to act both as a mediator and as a decision maker or special master. And we would envision that the person special master might, within the same case, go back and forth on the situation that's before them. So I think to try to say, well, this case is needs a mediator, and this other case needs a special master, sets up a decision process, which I don't think is one that we have in place, because I don't think a judge has enough wisdom early on to make that decision. So our special masters have both the authority to mediate and to also be a decision maker. So just to read you one of the paragraphs of the order appointing the special master, and then it says the duties: the special master shall explore opportunities for amicable resolution, and if the same is unsuccessful, shall undertake an investigation, engaging whatever employees are necessary, and then basically do what we would call a report and recommendation, an R&R. And you could have a situation where there's 10 issues, and the special master, using the mediation skills, resolves seven of those by agreement, and then rules on the other three outstanding issues in a report and recommendations. And some of the issues that actually are set forth in the order is if the special master has to conduct an investigation, they're supposed to make specific findings as to whether an adequate search has been conducted by each of the parties, whether the search proposed by each of the parties is adequate, whether the search terms proposed or the protocol proposed is reasonable, and then walks through the matrix for verifying the search, deals with the expense, whether it's proportionate, talks about filtering. So all those issues are within the order appointing the special master, and each of those issues can be resolved either wearing the mediation hat, or if that doesn't work, then by conducting an investigation and doing an R&R, which goes to the judge under Rule 53, and then there's the objection and the then opposition to any objection. So the order contemplates the special master fulfilling both roles. The other thing that's in place in our district is that most cases have a discovery of 120 to 150 days, and we all have the same order. All the judges use the same basic order and the same time schedule, which is usually, as I said, 150 days. Sometimes it's shorter, sometimes it's longer, but and that signals to the parties that there's a finite amount of time to have these matters resolved, so that you don't fall into the situation that Allison has mentioned, where people think they have forever to get this done, and that just feeds upon itself. So if a court has a fairly rigid time frame for discovery, that will operate somewhat as a control on how much, how long the discovery disputes will be, and how substantial they'll be, because they're going to run through the time to do discovery.
The second part that I was thinking about on this was I've done a number of shows with Judge Grimm, and one of his big passion points, one of his many, is Rule 502D to try to protect privilege. So one of the elements of it is the judge can just say, we're going to protect it. I don't care what your process is. It's protected. I want to move this case along. Privilege won't be waived. And you know, by fiat, it's in place. It's protected. Do you see the same toolkit sometimes with a special master with being able to say, I want this done. Let's appoint a special master. Let's move it along. Do you see the stick element at all potentially in the special master? Or is, I know cooperation is what we want, but is there the potential?
Well, I think what the special master brings to the table is, as I mentioned earlier, they're one, very knowledgeable, and thus if one of the parties is delaying for tactical reasons and using ESI disputes as part of that goal, a judge that doesn't have sufficient experience might not be able to tell whether the statements being made for counsel are genuine or not. The special master with the right expertise can cut through as to whether what's being told to the special master is accurate or not. So I think that's the advantage to a special master. And quite frankly, from a timing standpoint, our order appointing special masters, the court sets a time. We tell when it starts, when the appointment is made effective, and then the order puts in a date by which the report and recommendation must be provided. Similar to what we do in patent cases, we have a timetable that the special master needs to follow to get the report in after the close of briefing on the matter.
Great. Now, Tim, you've worked as a special master in complex litigation, and you know well the challenges of getting appointed. Do you think it's easier to get a special master agreed upon by the parties, or doesn't e-neutral seem like an easier sell?
Well, I think that special masters are usually appointed by the court in response to things that are going on specifically in the litigation, and it's typically a lack of agreement between the parties, and that's the reason for appointing the special master to begin with. So I think when there's a commonality of interest between the parties to do litigation in a certain manner, that I think the parties are far more likely to agree to an e-neutral role. But then again, the parties are far more likely to agree to most anything under those circumstances, and that would include the, you know, the appointment of a special master to speed things along. So I really think it depends more on the commonality of interest, may well depend on the jurisdiction and the comfort level. And part of the issue is that these things are all new, they are all new creatures to the court systems. And, you know, there's some reluctance by judges to appoint anyone in either of these capacities to somehow, you know, to hand their powers off to others to work through these issues. So, ultimately I think it comes down to whether or not there's a commonality of interest.
Federalism is what it sounds like. Everyone's got different approaches. They're trying to figure out the right way. Allison, another example of federalism, here's the Seventh Circuit program on e-discovery, which we've all heard about in the field, and they have a discovery liaison. So to further confuse matters, Allison, what's a discovery liaison, and does it have any role similar to special masters or e-neutrals?
Well, I have not participated in the program they have in the Seventh Circuit, but I did talk to someone that helped draft the materials that set the program in place, just to make sure I understood when the American College of E-Neutrals used the term e-discovery liaison, you know, what we meant versus what they meant in the Seventh Circuit program. And I think if you'll stop and think, that liaison in the Seventh Circuit program actually represents a party and is afforded, you know, attorney-client privilege, work product. So if the parties cannot resolve their e-discovery disputes, my understanding in that program is then the discovery liaisons would meet and can meet in front of the judge to resolve these issues. So what that means is there's still a place for the discovery liaisons in the Seventh Circuit to utilize an e-mediator or a special master, because the e-mediator and the special master are neutral. They don't represent either side, where the discovery liaison in that program does have a side and is not neutral. So I hope that makes the distinction. Carl, if you don't mind, I just want to add on to the questions that the judge and Tim were answering.
Yep.
When you're outside of the Western District of Pennsylvania or you're in state court, the parties may want to consider utilizing e-mediation to figure out or filter which are the big issues that would require either the special master to consider or go into the court. For example, I had a case in Miami. There were 7 sets of requests for production. They each had 250 requests each. And we were, we were really over a barrel, if you will. And what helped was using the e-mediation process to figure out, we had 3 major issues that we just couldn't agree to. So when we were able to go back to the court, or you could go back to a special master and define those 3 issues, we looked a lot more professional. We didn't look like children. We didn't look like we were having the animal house food fight. So you can utilize both processes very similarly to how Pennsylvania has it set up. But, something to consider, especially for state court practice.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to try to be creative with these new tools, no doubt about it. Well, let's, in wrapping up here, we do have the special master program in the Western District of Pennsylvania, and we have a list. Judge Schwab, would you care to tell our listeners where they can find out more information or check out the list, which I believe is online?
Certainly. If anyone goes to the United States District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania website, the initial screen that comes up on the right side has a tab for e-discovery/special master. So one just needs to click on that, and it'll be taken to a page which talks in terms of electronic discovery special masters and explains the mission of the court and how the special masters for e-discovery tie into the mission. And that link contains the approved list of eDiscovery Special Masters. And just as a way of background, we had an application process very similar that we had for the ADR neutral. So we were very experienced in developing an approval list. And many people in the local bar experience in eDiscovery helped us come up with a list, an application form that contained and sought information, contained questions and sought information relating to the applicant's experience as a mediator and experience with eDiscovery. And then the committee responsible for ADR voted on or approved certain people that were approved based upon these qualification criteria, and we then established an approved electronic discovery special master list, which is on the website. And that questionnaire could be used by any other court, state, or federal as a format to establish a similar program in different districts or other states.
And Allison, on your website, I know there's a lot of supplemental information as well. Is there any fees or any certification you go through? The Special Master Program Judge Schwab's talking about, I sat through 6 hours of mediation training, 4 hours of Special Master training, as well as going through a screening process with the background you bring into the field.
Similarly, the college has an application process because we've got to make sure that the e-neutrals not only have the training and background in the e-discovery, but also have the ADR training. So I have had folks inquire to join the college who maybe only just have the e-discovery background and explain, we at the college don't provide mediation or ADR training, but they need to go out and do that as required within their jurisdiction.
Great. Well, this has been a really nice show. I've enjoyed doing this. It's always neat to do shows on evolving areas in e-discovery, and this is clearly one of them. So I'd like to thank you, Judge Schwab, and Allison and Tim for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have knowledgeable speakers such as yourselves share your knowledge and experience with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And to our listeners, if you've enjoyed the podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. I'd like to thank our sponsor, Juranov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shinman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.